I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A terrific new collection of historical essays has been out for a while now, Vancouver Confidential. It's a terribly engaging and a book, and it covers a great deal. Its editor, John Belshaw, joins me now to talk about this volume, looking at the underbelly of Vancouver, this port city that was a hotbed of crime, corruption, and sex throughout the 20th century. The book covers the years of Vancouver up to the middle part of the century, the 20th century, that is. The team assembled are some of the best and brightest historians on Vancouver. Dan Francis, who was on recently, called them the Belshaw Group, a disparate group of enthusiasts on Vancouver history, doing tremendous work online and elsewhere to remember and contextualize the past. Essay contributors include Tom Carter, whose painting of Hastings in Maine serves as the book's cover, Aaron Chapman, Jesse Donaldson, Jesse Johnstone, Lanny Russworm, Eve Lazarus, Catherine Rose, Roseanne Sia, Jason Vanderhill, Stevie Wilson, Will Woods, Terry Watada, and Diane Purvey, with whom Dr. Belshaw wrote Vancouver Noir, 1930-1960. Vancouver Confidential is published by Anvil Press. John Belshaw is a historian, writer, consultant, professor, and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. I'll get him to tell us what's in this book and more. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program and studio, as it were, John Belshaw. Dr. Belshaw, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
That's great to be here.
So Vancouver Noir came out, what, 10 years ago?
Oh, no. Vancouver Noir came out in 2012.
Oh, okay.
Yes, 2012. So I guess just a couple of years ago.
What am I remember? I guess you wrote a book on, you and Diane, on, what do you call it, the roadside memorials.
Roadside shrines, yes. Public, private grief, public mourning, rise of the roadside shrine in British Columbia. That's right. And that came out about 10 years ago.
Okay, I see. So that's the timeline that I remember then. I remember I took that book out of the library. I don't have it. But that got a lot of attention when that came out, didn't it?
It certainly did. I guess it was rather well-timed. You know, in a way, what got us going there was raising questions around the country. We were noticing more and more roadside shrines around the province, no matter where we went. And we began to ask the usual questions. Where do they come from? Who builds them? Why do some of them seem to last a lot longer than others? What's their purpose? Are they there to be warnings? Are they memorial sites? Do people come there and regularly visit them? That sort of thing. And so it was a great project, and as I say, it seemed to be timed well. We certainly got a lot of calls, and I still every now and then have to field a call from some local community that's trying to decide whether or not they should put a limit on their roadside shrines, and whether they should introduce some legislation or some local guidelines. It's a good topic.
It's one of those books that I remember reading, and like every time I see a roadside shrine, I think about some of the questions that you ask in that book of, you know, who this person was, and why it's there, and if I see one week and it's gone the next week, what happened?
Yes.
You know, these are questions that pop up, and so I guess this is the power of some of your writing, some of your books, I guess, that people think about these things.
Oh, that's a great outcome.
So a lot of people are talking about Vancouver history nowadays, and have you noticed over the last 10 years that there has been, I should say, a greater interest in history of the city?
I think so, certainly in the time it took us to write Vancouver Noir, we got a very strong impression that there was an increase and a diversification of interest in the city's past. There's always been good scholarly interest in what's gone on in the past in Vancouver, but it tends to be focused in certain areas, I'm part of the academy and mea culpa. You know, we tend to dig our own furrows quite deeply and talk to other academics about what we're doing our research on. We're not necessarily very good at getting that out into the public. I mean, the exception that proves the rule and does so very well is Gene Barman, whose work on Stanley Park, for example, is really puts her into the camp of public scholars. And someone like Dan Francis has also been tremendous. I didn't know we called it the Belshaw Group. Thank you, Dan. I've always wanted a group of my own. I guess I'll have to grow my hair long and the band will go on the road again in the near future. Someone like Dan, who's an independent scholar, he's made a huge contribution. But most academics, as I say, dig a fairly narrow and straight furrow that stays within the academy. So there are lots of questions out there in the community that demand answers about the past.
And speaking of the Belshaw Group, I mean, the group of people that you have here in this book, I mean, for the most part, history isn't really their quote-unquote day job, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah. There are a total of three pointy-headed academics on the team, and Roseanne Sia, Diane Purvey, and myself. And the rest are freelancers, free agents. They're people who run house history tours. James Johnson, for example, does his house history work. He does research on house histories, and he runs walking tours in the East End and the West End. Will Woods, who's an actor, entrepreneur, bon vivant, and tour guide who does Forbidden Vancouver history tours. Kat Rose does the Sins of the City tours out of the Vancouver Police Museum. She's a member of the VPD. So there's a lot of people who have day jobs and yet maintain this powerful interest in Vancouver history. And it's really that part of their personalities that we came into contact with. And it was like this 25% of them that you don't really see on the surface. And yeah. We're kind of surprised to find they had these other lives.
Yeah, and following history as I have online, for example, a lot of these people are well known for their personas online. They have blogs, they have websites, yeah. Mm-hmm. They share a great deal on Twitter, Facebook, and the sort. It really adds to our understanding of history, doesn't it, the work that they all do?
Well, I think that's really where the project started, yeah. Like this awareness, Diane and I came to right around 2010, I guess, that there were a lot of people doing work on Vancouver history outside of the Academy, and they were doing it in these interesting venues, like history tours or blogs. Vancouver Was Awesome, mm-hmm. Lanny Russworm's piece. Vancouver Vanishes, those kinds of things. Eve Lazarus's work on the history of neighborhoods and the people who lived in houses around the city, where they lived, how they moved, who they connected with. A lot of that was either occurring in an electronic virtual environment or on the side of the streets. And as I say in the introduction to the book, when you think about it on a good day, there are more people studying Vancouver history or learning about Vancouver history from this group than will be in any number of classrooms around the province or indeed around the world. This is where the rubber hits the road. This is where people learn about Vancouver history.
So the period that's covered in the book, as I said in the introduction, it goes up to, say, the mid part of the 20th century, right?
Yeah, it really runs from about 1914 to about 1950, 55.
What's fascinated you about that period in Vancouver's history?
Well, I think if you think about the kinds of histories that are written have been written in the past about Vancouver, and I'm thinking here of the big tomes that sit on people's shelves, Mill Town to Metropolis, I think captures it. It suggests a progress from the sort of frontier city into a modern day, world class city, and it suggests a line that's almost perfectly 45 degree angle, going across the graph paper, heading upward, all ever upward. And this period in between, between 1930 and 1960s, is just one big trough. I mean, there's some little blips that go upward, but for the most part, it's not conforming to this standard parable or narrative of a city that's going from. It's getting every day is getting and in every way is getting better and better. In fact, and there are plenty of times when the city is getting much, much worse. And so it doesn't fit into that narrative. So it tends to be passed over, or you get a couple of stories out of it. Well, there was this scandal and there was that scandal, but it doesn't really matter because on the whole, things were getting better and better. And so it makes for an interesting period to get down into that trough and see how people who if they're living in that period from, say, the 1920s through the 1940s, there's a long period of time into the 1950s, into the 1960s, and they're thinking, maybe things just never will get better. Maybe this is the norm. And certainly generations grow up in that period. People are born, they live, they die within that period. Their understanding of Vancouver, their entire experience of it, is in a trough. And that to me is fascinating. They don't see Vancouver as a place as a city that's going places. They see it as a place that's pretty much hit the wall.
And so what was the feeling like? And I mean, one does get a sense of what it was like to live in Vancouver in those years. On the whole, was it a less safe time? Was there a great criminal element in the city? I mean, there is a criminal element now.
Yeah.
But then, was it say more pronounced or?
Well, I think different types of crime. That's a fairly obvious statement. Certainly, when the economy turns down in 1929, 1930, the number of assaults. It's almost immediate. The number of assaults goes up quite sharply. The police commissioner's reports, the police chief's annual reports show a sharp increase in violent crime as the economy sinks. And that goes up and down throughout the 1930s. There's a period of the 1940s, and this is part of Diane's work on the Viola Woolridge case. There's a part in the time in the 1940s when you've got demobilized soldiers who have access to handguns. They have and of course they're dropping these weapons all over the place.
Yeah.
There's lots of guns around, and the amount of gunplay in the streets in Vancouver is really quite striking. It's I think a much more dangerous place in a very casual sense there, because gunplay did just break out from time to time.
We got a sense of that, didn't we, in the Arts Club's production of Helen Lawrence. What did you make of that, the Stan Douglas, what's the guy's name? I had him on, actually, Da Vinci. The guy, Chris Haddock.
Chris Haddock, right. I thought it was, it's a pretty bold experiment in visual art. As far as the story goes, I thought it's pretty much on the numbers.
Yeah.
They wanted to recreate the sensibility of post-war Vancouver, early post-war Vancouver, and the sense that it's more of a frontier in some ways than the frontier phase. There's the extent to which people are engaging in crime, street crime, trying to find their way, trying to find a niche they can move back into after the war and the dislocations of the war, trying to find housing, the level of discrimination in the city, the level of corruption in the police force, which was absolutely outrageous. All of those things come together quite nicely in Helen Lawrence, and I thought it was an entertaining evening out.
It was, in the way that they did it, and the sort of Vancouver that you saw. And that's the other thing about the Vancouver, through the pictures that I saw in Vancouver Confidential, and some of the images that your fellow writers have painted through their prose. Mm-hmm. It's a Vancouver that's 50 years plus away from where we are. But it's also familiar, and I guess that's because one lives here and one recognizes the street corners or a sense of what Vancouver is and who these people were and who we've become, I guess.
I think so. I mean, that's if you're doing history well, and I think a number of the contributors to this book absolutely hit the right notes, you find the commonalities between the past and the present, between the human experience, so it becomes possible for the reader to imagine a time that's different, to place themselves in a time that's different, and to understand the kinds of motivations that people had at the time and the things that concerned them, things that frightened them, things that made them happy, and that creates a bigger Petri dish. Basically, you know you're part of it. You're swimming in this stuff too. To borrow Doug Copeland's line, you know, you're soaking in it.
Yeah.
It's part of who you are now. You're in that history, and I think that's what comes through in a number of these pieces.
As a historian, do you look to the past to say understand where we are today? I mean, I always ask historians this. For predictions, and they say, well, historians, you shouldn't ask a historian for a prediction. But I'm assuming that looking at the past can sort of give you some insight as to where we are and perhaps where we're headed. Does it for you?
Not precisely. I mean, I make some predictions on the track or something like that, but I feel much more comfortable doing that. No, the past offers lessons, but they're not necessarily predictive lessons. as I said, 1929, the economy crashes, and there's violence in the streets within a matter of months. So what we should learn from that is that when the desperate times call for desperate measures, you know, not to be surprised if the economy tanks and suddenly lawlessness breaks out. It's not a predictive capacity, but it gives you some insights into how people think and how they work. But I don't hold with it being terribly useful. I'd be a whole lot better off if I could just use it as a predictive tool.
Like for the lotto or something,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
In terms of race, because some of the pieces in the book touch on our racial history and how we've interacted with one another, we like to Canadians, I think, in general, like to think that we have a better history of race than, say, the Americans. Mm. But it's clear that we haven't done terribly better, have we?
No, actually. And I think it's writ large in British Columbia and Vancouver. Yeah. There aren't a lot of cities that have the kinds of enclaves that we have. And certainly when looking at Chinatown or Japantown, I mean, those are and Hogan's Alley, too, of course, the Afro-Canadian neighborhood. Two of the three of them have been pretty much gutted out of existence, and the third one, Chinatown, is it's not entirely on the ropes, but it's certainly going through a massive transition right now. It's important, I think, for Vancouverites to appreciate the kind of active hostility that existed, the lack of inclusiveness, and yet also at the same time, the extent to which Vancouverites very often just ignored those boundaries that they were told, these boundaries are really important, you mustn't cross this line, don't mix with those people, don't trust those people because they hate you because of the way you look. Yet the frequency with which people cross those lines and just ignored them and said, you know, I'll make my friends where I make my friends, I'll hang out with the people I want to hang out with, I'll do business with people I trust regardless of what they look like or who they are. I judge a person by their personality and their character. You know, that sort of thing comes through too, and which is, I think, you know, it's encouraging. But again, it occurs within a context of hostility and fear and quite intense fear and hostility too. It's important to keep that in mind, that this was a real driving force in Vancouver history, and it remains an important one too. I mean, if you were to suggest, for example, that the Aboriginal sites in Stanley Park should be returned to the Aboriginal community, people would be up in arms, I think. The idea to punch a hole in the middle of Stanley Park so as to return property to people, you know, that's just unthinkable for most Vancouverites. Let's return Dead Men's Island to the bands around Burrard Inlet. I think there'd be a huge hue and cry about it, and that reflects an ongoing, ongoing hostility about class, about race. Sorry.
Yeah. There's also the class element, which you touch upon in the book. But I want to talk about the essay that you contributed. This fellow James Crookall. These are photographs, and you've included some of them in the book, and they're aesthetically they're beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
He's a real artist. They're iconic photographs as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew those photographs before I even knew of the guy because I only read about the guy in your book.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come across James Crookall, and to build into that, who was he and the work that he did?
Well, I was. Part of the research we were doing for Vancouver Noir, we're looking at older photographs. It actually, the thrust of that book was that we'd seen an exhibition been to an exhibition at the MoMA in San Francisco, the Museum of Modern Art, and it was on, you know, San Francisco noir-ish subjects, and they had all these great black and white photographs in the gallery. And both Diane and I said, you know, we've seen photographs like this in Vancouver. And the presentation in the United States was, isn't this remarkably exceptional? And that's, you know, part of American exceptionalism, right? Isn't this only in America could you have photographs like this? We thought, nah, that's rubbish. We've seen plenty of these in Vancouver. Hey, wait a second. How does the noir era play out in Vancouver? What's going on the street? But also, how do those photographs of crime scenes connect to the way people were behaving? are the photographs a reflection of how they were or how they saw themselves? Are they trying to be Humphrey Bogart? Are they trying to be Hollywood noir characters? Or is Hollywood taking its cues from people on the streets? What's that relationship like, and how does that play out in Canada, in a Canadian city? And so I spent a lot of time looking at photographs of Vancouver in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and this one photographer's stuff kept coming up. And I can remember the photograph that really cued something for me. It was outside the Marine Building. It's a picture of somebody walking towards the Marine Building. It's probably a Sunday because nobody else seems to be around in the street. There's no cars. And the person's just in the process of hopping up onto the curb. And for this moment, you've got the back of this person. They're wearing a hat. They're wearing a trench coat. The trench coat's just beginning to fill out with air as they jump up and onto the curb. And their feet are off the ground. They're hovering just off the sidewalk. And I thought, I've seen this someplace else. And I started going through these photographs. And I'd find these pictures of people who were just in the process of lifting their feet off the ground. And you'd see them from behind. I thought, this is the same guy. He's taken all these. This is his thing. He watches people until they're just about airborne, and that's when he gets them. And he likes to shoot them from behind. And I realized this was Jim Crookall. He had a couple of things that he was interested in. One was the crowds when they don't think you're looking.
Yeah.
He very, very seldom, in fact, took pictures of people face on. Those are rare in the Crookall collection. He was also really interested in geometrical angles, triangles in particular, and you see this in the architectural photographs he took of Vancouver. Some wonderful angular shots that you go back to those buildings, you realize, I guess that's what the architect had in mind there. It was all a series of points and lines, and Crookall saw that in a way that a lot of us just don't. He had a really good sense of aesthetics, an interesting sense of aesthetics. And he turned out to be a fascinating character. You know, during the First World War, he was responsible for taking photographs of airplane crashes as the first air forces were getting up and running. These horrible biplanes that were made of chicken wire and whatever else, and hope more than anything else, I suppose. And they'd crash to the ground, and everything would be splintered up. And of course, nobody walks away because they hadn't invented parachutes yet.
Yeah.
And it was his job to document this stuff, and so he went through that process, and then became in his spare hours, a photographer. He was very much an amateur.
Do you think after this that he'll be as well known or as highly regarded as, say, Herzog or Kurt Lang?
I'd like to think that he would be. I certainly think he should be more appreciated in Vancouver. I think some of the photographs he took on the streets in Vancouver in the 1930s in particular, if he had been in New York, you'd have those photographs on coffee mugs. I think he would be considered a civic treasure, and certainly I consider him something of a civic treasure for Vancouver.
And it's great, isn't it? In the last couple of years, Fonsi Police has had his day in the sun, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And these are all very different photographers, you know.
Yeah.
Herzog was doing something very different. Kurt Lang's stuff. I think it's interesting, you know, look for the relationship they have with people on the streets. And some of those photos, Herzog, there's quite a few people. Kurt Lang's stuff, it's who dropped the neutron bomb. The buildings are there, but the people are all gone. Where are they? And Fonsi's stuff, of course, it's all about that individual coming towards you. How do I catch this individual in such a way that they're going to want to buy my photograph? And it's a very, very tight little cash nexus, the commercial relationship that he has to establish within an instant of taking that photograph. And they're motivated in very different ways. And I think Crookall was probably the most... He was the most candid of the lot. I think he took more photographs and better photographs of crowds in Vancouver. So you see hundreds of people on the streets, and you think, okay, that's the city. It's not the building; it's the people in the city, and he captures it. He's really good with photographs involving kids. You don't get a sense of them being just kids. You get a sense of them being individuals who are in the process of seeing something and being involved with something. I think it's exciting stuff.
Do you think 50 years hints. We'll be looking at the selfies that we're taking now and the Instagram photos and looking at them the same way.
There's a growing body of scholarship on selfies, let me tell you.
In the acknowledgments, you do a wonderful thing where you acknowledge some of the great historians who've gone before. You mentioned Gene Barman, who's still very much with us and whose output is continues and continues to astonish and astound and fascinate all of us. But you mentioned some of the folks who've gone before, who are since gone, people like Margaret Ormsby and Chuck Davis.
Yeah.
Did you know Chuck well?
No, I met Chuck maybe twice. Although my Chuck Davis story, he used to have his office in the Sun Tower, the old tower down on Pender.
The Taylor Building.
The Taylor Building, right? Pender and Beatty. And this is back about 1981, 82, and I called him. I wanted to interview him about something, some historical research I was doing, and I called him, and he had the first telephone answering machine that I'd ever encountered.
Yeah.
And so it's, hi, this is Chuck Davis, and I start talking, of course, and of course, completely blown. In fact, what it said, he started off by saying, hi, hear this, and he clearly held the phone out the window, and you'd hear traffic honking. That's the sound of the city. This is me, the sound of Chuck Davis. You know, it was great. He was being funny. He got this he was the early adapter of telephone answering machines, and immediately he started playing with it, having fun with it. And I thought, well, that really was his personality. He was a very playful researcher, and he was a lot of fun.
And you guys that are part of Vancouver Confidential, you really are the inheritors of his legacy, aren't you? Because it's hard to believe that one guy did all that for all those years.
Yeah, he certainly put out a prodigious amount of work. I think there's actually a huge pool of Vancouver historians out there over the years a very big pool of Vancouver historians. I mean, Bob McDonald comes to mind, too. Karen, Kay Anderson stuff. There's some really good people out there who've contributed in very different ways. I think one of the things Chuck did was he wanted to. There are popular historians and populist historians and people's historians. I think Chuck's kind of a people's historian. He wanted to give this stuff back to people. He said, look, this is all stored away in the archives. It's stored away in the Vancouver Sun. I want you guys to have this stuff. And in that sense, I think this is very much part of his legacy. This is a way of giving this information and these stories back to the people of Vancouver.
So what's next for you? Are you working on something now?
I'm actually in the process of writing an open text on Canadian history, which is part of the provincial government and BC campus's open text project. It's a huge project, and it's really exciting stuff, and I hope it'll do a lot to change the nature of textbooks in Canada. But beyond that, no, I haven't got a plan just yet. I'm still recovering from this one.
but this one has been received quite well, hasn't it? It's been a bestseller and...
Yeah, I'm extremely pleased with how well it's been received. I think part of the enthusiasm about it, I think it's gratifying because it makes us feel like, well, we were right. People do want to hear those stories. People do want to have their history repatriated to them. You know, when you read Tom Carter's piece on the entertainment czars in Vancouver, and you realize that Vancouver had this reputation as a place you could, you know, you start out the evening at 6, you go for a bite to eat, you go see a show, you have dinner afterwards, maybe take in a dance thing and maybe go dancing, but, you know, there could be a floor show at a place, there's all these supper clubs, you go to the Palomar and hear some jazz, you know, maybe wind up at the Buddha and listen to some, you know, really rough around the edges blues band playing, and again finish off the evening with some drinks, and perhaps then go to the burlesque show down the road that was running till 5 in the morning. You know, it was a really exciting place to be. There were tons and tons of theaters in this town, and live venues by theater. I mean, live venues. And so I think people want to know that the city had that kind of life, and that it's possible to build a city like that, too.
Yeah, I went to your book launch, which was when we're taping this. This is October 21st. It was a month ago, exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
I was only there for the first hour because I had somewhere else to be. But it was in that first hour that I was there. It was jam packed.
Yeah, it's great
and,
fun.
Yeah, and so I mean that must be heartening that a lot of people came out for that, and a lot of people are enthusiastic about the work that you all are doing.
Yeah, it is very, very gratifying. You put together a team of contributors, and you kind of hope for the best. You worry about things like attrition. Who's going to fall by the wayside? We lost one person, and at the very outset, we knew that it was Jim Wong Chu. We knew he had a ton of commitments and that this might be a bridge too far for him, but he gave us two other writers in his place. So everybody came together right down to the finish line. They co-wrote, they co-edited one another's piece. They worked together collaboratively, and brought their respective strengths to the table. So that by the end of it, it really felt like a team. And I think that kind of enthusiasm has bubbled over a bit for this one. It's been a great process.
Yeah, and it must be encouraging as an academic that people are interested in history, aren't they? I mean, you know, the people are buying this not just because they know you.
It's true.
People do care about what happened.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, in this respect, I'm on record about this, but, you know, Doug Copeland says this is a city with no history, right? And I completely disagree with him. I think he's so completely wrong. And for a guy who thinks the city has no history, he keeps littering the place with images that tell us that it does have a history. If it didn't have a history, none of those things would resonate, right? You know, whether it's the Lego killer whale or the raindrop, whatever, it resonates precisely because it has a soul. And the history of a place is its soul. If you mentioned older generations, well, you know, think about Aaron Chapman's book about the penthouse.
Yeah.
it was one of those books that everybody, when it came out, everybody bought a copy for their dad.
Yeah.
Right? Not knowing that the penthouse is where Dad met your mom. Generations went to the penthouse and hung out there and got into some measure of trouble at the penthouse. And that's part of a city's soul. I mean, I can remember going to the cave shortly before it closed down and seeing, you know, B.B. King one week and the Pointed Sticks another. Yeah. It was a great venue, and it's a point of pride for Vancouverites to be able to say that, I went to those places. I had a great time. And I met some really interesting people, and that felt exciting. That's what a city should feel like.
Were you born in Vancouver?
Yeah, I was.
And you've lived elsewhere through...
Off and on, yeah. Yeah. I spent some time in the interior and elsewhere in B.C.
The island. What's brought you back? I mean, there must be something about... I mean, I know professional engagements and the sort lead one to certain cities throughout their life, but I mean, there must be something other than that that's kept you... that's brought you back to Vancouver.
Yeah, I think that's true. Both Diane and I are Vancouverites. My father was born in Vancouver, in point of fact, so we were well established in terms of Vancouver. You know, families have deep roots here, and I lived abroad for a while. I lived in the UK for a while, and of course, you never feel more like a Vancouverite than when you're living in a different city, I guess. You know, it's the same no matter where you go. You remember more feel like who you were at home than when you're abroad. There are things about the city that I really love and appreciate. It strikes me as it's a place where the extraordinary can happen and does on a fairly regular basis. And I've been in cities where the only thing that happens is the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's possible is the ordinary. And in Vancouver, the extraordinary is possible. I think, you know, I often reference my friend Paul Yee in this respect, who's another historian, writer, archivist, has written children's books. He grew up in the neighborhood in which I live now, in Strathcona, in pretty unassuming circumstances, and he's contributed a huge amount to our literature and our knowledge of the city, and He's an extraordinary guy, and there's just a lot of people like that. This is a team of extraordinary writers and extraordinary individuals. That's what I like about Vancouver.
Yeah, well, you guys have done a great service in putting this book out and putting it together. This is a book that I suspect a lot of people, and I say this of recent historical books, that people will be reading years from now. And I think that's a great achievement. It's a pleasure to meet you. I've been a great admirer of your work over the years, and I appreciate coming in to do this.
Thanks very much, Joe.
Vancouver Confidential is the name of the book. It's from Anvil Press. Its editor, John Belshaw, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.